Last Friday at Baltimore's Enoch Pratt Free Library, I moderated a conversation with a political couple, James Carville and Mary Matlin, about their new book, Love and War, 20 Years, Three Presidents, Two Daughters, and One Louisiana Home. Now, Carville is a Democrat who was the genius behind Bill Clinton's presidential campaign. Mary Matlin ran Bush's campaign and served in the Bush White House, the second Bush White House. And so they've always been at odds. They used to have a TV show together. They went at it as Republican and Democrat. And this book details their seemingly mismatched relationship, which really wasn't. And it's about America and how everything has changed over the last several decades. And here's the conversation.
I got to say, this book, I don't know how many of you read this book yet, but it's really quick read, easy read. And one of the things that struck me, looking at this book. One was the Catholic Church and a role that played in this marriage, in your lives, and also some of the arguments y'all had, and in the power of the marriage, the power of the church, what it meant to you, what it meant to your mom, James, and all the rest.
Well, I was a pre-Vatican II altar boy, so I could rip off a pretty good confidio right now if I had to. What was interesting is that we told a story. My wife and I spoke at the Al Smith Dinner in 2010. And New Orleans is a lot like Baltimore. It's the real place of neighborhoods and culture and tradition and things like that. Every time I come here, I always feel I'm probably as comfortable here as I am in most any other American city because in many ways it's the same kind of place. But at any rate, I'm a kind of statistical freak. I got married when I was 49 and I've only been married once.
You could omit statistical.
We got married in New Orleans in 1993, and so often the case we got married, justice of the Supreme Court and whatever. So we moved back to New Orleans, and my wife took up Catholicism, and so we decided we were going to get remarried in the church. And so the church that we went to was a place called St. Stephen's on Napoleon Avenue. And it's the kind of thing on Easter Vigil they'll do, like two baptisms, and you reconsecrated in the Catholic Church. And so my sister and everybody came down, and so I get this phone call on Monday that's kind of, we're not alone. She said, oh my God, I just happened to be going through stuff, and I ran across Paul and Lala, who are paternal grandparents, and they were married at St. Stephen's in April of 1910. And so 100 years later, and it just like, I don't know if I'm supernatural or signed, any of that, but I had said, I want desperately my great-grandchildren to get married in 2110 in April. I just thought it was like a great, I'm very big into kind of continuity and family and tradition and all that kind of stuff, and it was just one of the. And in the book, we have a copy of the marriage certificates next to each other, and that's what it's. That's what it's about. If tradition and family and cultures, you got to know how to peel a crab. You know, let Mary talk and go a bit too long here, but I'm a big believer. I'm like a cultural Ayatollah. And my daughter came to me one time, and the Cajorna came to me one time and said, Dad, would you give us a ride to Pinkberry? And I said, what in the hell is damn Pinkberry? It was a yogurt place. I said, I'll tell you one damn thing, we don't yogurt in this family, we eat snowballs, okay? I'm not taking you to a yogurt place.
Pre or post Vatican II, we don't need to use GD, okay? What an interesting place to start, because there is a Catholic bond here, and there are very few cities that are so held together, and Chicago being one of them was my home. This being one, New Orleans. I was raised a Methodist because this is why I love history so much. My mother's side, both sides are ethnic. In my the old country, my daddy's a Croatian and my mother's from Ireland. And as it turns out, her father was Protestant and her mother was Catholic, and her father forbade her mother to practicing her Catholicism. I never knew any of this until after I'm getting goosebumps telling this, after I converted, my sister sent me the crucifix, the keys to the kingdom, and all the various things that my grandmother had spirited away from her husband and gave to my mother for safekeeping, and my mother died young, gave them to my sister for safekeeping. So this is not a political statement. I'm an empiricist. I'm an outcome-based. I'm reasonable. I'm an Aristotelian Christian. So through going...
Is that allowed in the church?
Well, that's my priest and I fought for a long time, and this was during... I did not start out to convert, but I said, just give me 100 books to read, and he... had gone to seminary at age 30. He was BMW driving, hot. What we call father. What a waste. You know what I mean? And he doesn't mind being called that either. It turns out he went to NAC, the North American College of Rome in Rome, when Cardinal Dolan was the rector for the new formation. So his whole class, they're upcoming bishops now, and very intellectual. And he gave me 100 books to read, and each was more reinforcing than the next. So I came to it via reason more than faith.
You're listening to my conversation with prominent political couple James Carville and Mary Matlin about their latest book, Love and War, 20 Years, 3 Presidents, 2 daughters, and 1 Louisiana home. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll be back with much more of this conversation. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner.
Chase. Life's something that seeks its level.
I Wanna Be Evil by Eartha Kitt. She was born on this day in 1927, and Eartha Kitt was one of the most amazing singers ever, defined a genre and a way of being, and she graced our show in the late 1990s, just a lovely lady, Eartha Kitt. Welcome back, I'm Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And this hour, we're bringing you a conversation I had with political couple James Carville and Mary Matlin about their new book, Love and War, 20 Years, 3 Presidents, 2 Daughters, and 1 Louisiana Home. It took place at the Enoch Pratt Free Library. And before the break, I asked them a question about the importance of their Catholic faith. And here's Mary Matlin.
The faith, is a gift. It's such a gift. And it's such a journey. But if you live in a place like this, or you move to a place like New Orleans post-Katrina, I could... see the hand of God. You see the hand of God. It was the church. It wasn't that pulled organized enough and organized multi-denominationally. The archbishop calls, everybody comes of every denomination, and they get it done. And I kept saying, Einstein said, God's way of remaining anonymous is coincidences. So,
did I mention that my early religious instruction was the Baltimore Catechism?
And I was telling you before we went on the air here that you're 3 blocks from Frenchtown. The Cajuns came here, and then they went to New Orleans, a lot of them. Some of your relatives might have lived here way back when. It's possible.
Not his people. I've met enough Baltimore people. No, he's his Acadians are a little peculiar to his Acadia.
So I started that way because To me, there was like this little piece of undertext in the book that throughout, well, you're going back to the White House, the Iraq War, Bush winning, Gore losing, these very tense times in your relationship. One of the things I think you said in the book, Jim, was that I stick things out. I'm staying with this woman. I'm not divorcing. And besides, we're Catholic, and that can't happen. I'm not going to let it happen. I mean, that was a piece that kind of just struck me, that was kind of a power piece. That may not have been the theme of the book, but it was a power piece inside the book. That's why I started there. It felt like it to me anyway.
I didn't read that part. I read his half of the book we wrote 20 years ago, so I had to read that part. I wasn't Catholic. I didn't know. So you were not going to divorce me just because your religion, not because you love me?
No, I just... No, I never thought about getting divorced. I was going to get divorced. Well, my family, it's not something that Carvilles do anyway, so I never thought about it.
Well, I mean... Given all the stuff you wrote about, if it wasn't a lot of deep love inside of this, even the church couldn't have kept you together. I mean, so with the things you said in the book, things like the pieces that really got to you were political, even though you tried to keep the politics out of your marriage, separate from the conversations, the things that hit you, like that you two wrote about intensely, which was when the Bush v. Gore, that period. I mean, that was hard, really hard. You're losing the election. I mean, not you, but I mean Bush losing the election when...
I pretty much lost it.
But you didn't lose the election.
I pretty much am responsible for that stinking loss, yes.
The arguments over the Iraq War, all that. These were intense moments for you guys.
But I mean, I felt very passionate about... I mean, if you got to have a fight in your family, have one over a war, not, you know, how much sugar you put in your coffee. You know, it was a...
Although he did fight about that, too.
Yeah, he fight about a lot of things. But, we've been married for 20 years. And the last major thing we had, the way that we do it, I do it, I'm a big believer in just kick the can down the road. Just don't confront the crap. Just don't speak for a month. And that way you're not going to say anything stupid that, you know, is going to come back. It's better just to... let it go. Everybody wants to confront everything. Oh, my God, let's deal with this right. No, don't deal with it right now. Just let it go.
And I am the opposite.
I'm not for that.
I like to argue. I like to debate. I don't like to argue. I'm just opinionated. So we would be riding running cars, and we'd be talking about this. And one day, he rolled down the window. It was cold out. He stuck his head out the window, just stopped talking. And I said, what are you doing? He goes, it takes two to fight. If I don't talk, you can't fight. Talk out that other window if you want, but I'm not going to fight with you. So that's how he did that. But also, it's emotional or trying or traumatic, as you all know, as every person knows, is on a scale. In these same 20 years... his mother was 5 years comatose with Alzheimer's. We went through my daddy's 7 years of cancer. We went through his baby brother's unexpected death. We had our own kids at 42 and 45. He had to get an epidural for both of them. He was so out of control. So we had... And we're old. I'm 60 and he's... we're not old. I love this age. I am so happy to be in my third act. We're empty nesters now. And he's like, my life is over. To which I say, what am I, chopped liver? Come on, this is third act. Let's go. But there... So yes, we could fight and we get angry and we didn't talk about it. But boy, when you're... Daddy calls and says, I've got multiple myeloma. He has five sisters. You know, his mother, for 5 years, comatose with Alzheimer's, dementia, and Parkinson's, never once was in a hospital. Never once. The five sisters, who all have families of their own, their 40 nieces and nephews, rotated nights and stayed with her mother, Miss Nippy, his mother. So those are the things that if you you're not going to talk about on Tim Russert or, you know, George's show on Sunday morning, but that's the essence of our lives, not hanging chads.
But that's what came through for me in the book. I mean, you all were, the politics was all through the book because that's who you all are. Mm-hmm. But it was the power of both your families and where you came from, what that represented to you, what those little girls meant to you when they were born, how that changed existence. I mean, that's a huge theme here, and I think that people who marry, divorce, run away, I've done that. But what I got from it is it was really a very powerful testimony of what love means and what family means beyond the gloss over, you know. I mean, beyond the arguments.
You make a really good point. And this is something that I've noticed is if you become well-known for something, then that's all people know about you. That's a guy that argues on TV, or that's Bill Clinton's guy, or she's the one you on Sunday morning TV, or she was... whatever. I'm just serious. Is that they... Or it's the same thing if you're an athlete or they listen to you on the radio or they know what you're on the radio. There's a whole other side. And what we really try to do with this book is talk about the other side. Now, in the last 20 years, we've been, you know, either ringside or in the ring for some pretty big stories of the whole Clinton impeachment brouhaha, the 9/11, you name it, the Rock Walk, the Katrina reconstruction. We've been taught at ground zero. So we wanted to talk about that, but also, you know, I grew up the oldest of eight kids in a place called Carville, Louisiana, believe it or not. It was named after my grandfather, who was a postmaster, which, by the way, a very famous place in medical history. We're the largest, foremost hospital for the treatment of Hansen's, but you would think of as leprosy in Carville.
Also, only the Carvilles lived there, hence the name Carville.
Yeah, but there's a whole other side, and people become formed, and you're a part of that. And what was really cool, and then going back, I remember when the word got out that we're moving, at a reliable section of the Post called and says, "Why are you moving?" And I said, "Look, I'm just an old Jew. I'm going back to my Jerusalem. That's all I can tell you. We're leaving, you know. I've been in New York long enough." I mean, I was glad. I wasn't running away from anything. We talked about that a lot. But I really am married. Always loved it. We got married. She wanted to get married there. And I, at some level, I was struck with the fragility, and we both were, with the fragility of the culture. And we wanted to. We lost over 1,000 trumpets. All right, that can't be passed from one. That you can't go to the conservatory and learn this stuff. It can only be passed from generation to generation. And there were like fundraising efforts to raise money for musical instruments to give them to kids and stuff. And so it really, and we tried to get this across in the book, but much more than the sort of political side, is the sense of culture, the sense of continuity, the kind of sense of family, if you will. And, you know, and it just so happened, you know, that, I mean, things really took off and it worked out much better than anybody could expect. We didn't know that when we moved.
If I can add to that, kids, you're all book people, or you wouldn't be part of this library series, and what a beautiful library. I love books. I love being in libraries. I am in publishing. I got a Kindle. I got all the devices, but I like to touch and smell and keep books. But I don't like to write books. And after the last one, I said, that was like giving birth without an epidural, and I'm never going to do it again. But 20 years later, what I discovered in New Orleans, we were doing, when you're at rock bottom, we had nothing. As our mayor said, we were 15 feet underwater. This is after we had the Super Bowl there. And now we're number one in so many categories it's not worth naming. And issues that hadn't been in my portfolio, I was in security and economic issues, and I wasn't in education, those kinds of issues. But to watch the education reform, we are now number one, not just in the state, but in the country on education reform. How did we do it? Well, Harvard would come down, and Johns Hopkins, people would come down, and they'd say how we were doing it. I said, why can't we say how we're doing it? Because you have to, it is, and I said, there's so many things I want to say. I want to put in some format that it can be possibly usable in some altered form or a prototype for other cities. My next project I want to do is Detroit, which is in the same sort of...
You want to do that?
He does.
I'm out of projects.
Well, I grew up in the Midwest. I'm a Motown kind of girl, and the city is hard to do. Our dear mutual friend Rahm Emanuel's in Chicago, my hometown, trying to do some of these things, and the impediments, the political impediments and infrastructure are so great that he can't. But when you are so at rock bottom like we were, so that was the motivation of the book for me. So for you book lovers is what I'm saying. It's really a hodgepodge. I'd like to... It has a lot of different stuff in it. We didn't structure it. We don't work together very well. He writes, I'm very fastidious and organized and like to write in longhand. And he likes to take a bottle of Maker's Mark, lay down on the couch, and get a microphone and spit it out. And it comes out picture perfect. He's brilliant. It's one of his. It was the brilliant part of ADHD.
Fun. It was really, really. I'd get in. We got a tape recorder. And I'd ride all over South Louisiana and just sort of talk. But it was a really fun project, and you know, be able to do that, and you know, nothing focuses the attention like a hanging every fortnightly or writing a book, one of the two.
Right. New Orleans also brought you. I mean. It wasn't a huge part of the book again. This little piece I keep picking out, but you actually agreed on a candidate.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Together.
Who's up for re-election in a month.
Right, but you all agreed on a candidate.
I couldn't. When I moved there, and he wasn't going to, he was obviously the best guy, and I chased him down. I wouldn't let him say, man, I can't move my kids down here. You got to run for mayor. And if you live in a city like this, it really matters who the mayor is. The governor is, but if you live in the city of Baltimore, the mayor is much more instrumental in your everyday life and the decisions they make than a governor is. I know it's like that in New Orleans. You know, it profoundly kind of matters in that sense. And Mary did. She was all, and still, I mean, we're all in here. We still got a lot of work left to do here. And the difference, you can really see, and that was one of the great things, is you can really be Danny Meyer, the great New York restaurateur, does a lot of stuff here, and we were riding around, and he said, what's the difference? You know, like, we were at the New York Public Library, the 80 branches. It's enormous. It's a great, iconic institution. But if you contribute or participate in this library, you can actually feel it. You can see it. You know, and I said, if you raise money for the Metropolitan Art Museum, I mean, it matters. It's a great, world-class, top-of-the-line thing, but it's just there. He said, yeah, like if you throw a rock, you can see the concentric circles. You can actually see some effect of what you do. Right. And that was what the remarkable thing is. You get a guy, hey, we really want you to run for mayor. We'll help you. We'll do whatever you want. And you can see it actually make a difference. It just doesn't. And the other thing to remember is this, that we're in a very fragile place, a very fragile culture, very environmentally fragile. You don't want to get started on coastal erosion, wetlands. You got a lot of that going on here. As you know, the here, as much as we know, the salinity and the brackishness and the mixture of the water is a very delicate thing. It's been built up over a long period of time that can make us very productive, fecund, or whatever the word I'm looking for is, but it can also turn around on you. So all of these things, it's not really a given that we're going to be there 50, 75 years from now. It's always a struggle, so and that makes it in some ways more interesting.
Which is the other point of why I wanted to work on this book, because he said, because our kids were 10 and 12, they weren't ready to be uprooted. And we kept talking about post-Katrina, and all dear friends of mine down in Brazil lost her whole family. She's still, I think she's finally found them, but she's 7 years later, she's finally housed them all. And it was just so emotional. And he kept saying, sugar, we're going to become a city on a river. I'm from Chicago. Anything that follows sugar, I'm going to go for. But so we're there for 2 years, and it was so, nothing was happening. And I said, oh, what have I done to these girls? You know, we're responsible for them. So he took a poll, and I liked Mitch Landrieu, who is a Democrat, because of this. He came into my kitchen one New Year's Day. The New Year's Day tradition is, you know, the beans and the cabbage and all that. And he goes, sugar, I need to get up in your pots. And I'm like, get up in my pots? Well, it followed sugar, so I said, you can get up in my pots, whatever. And so we talked about it, and I said, I'm a conservative. I know why I'm a conservative. I can support this. I can't support that. He goes, I'm just a practical. If you come to my office and you've got a solution, I'm going to listen to you. You come to my office and you want to divide, and when you have had these old fights, forget about it. We don't have. I got too much to do. And he has five kids of his own, so it's been a blessing to work with him. And I wanted to say, in this time when, in this book, in this time when we're also like have political fatigue and race fatigue and all these fight fatigues, he won with 67% of the black vote, 67% of the white vote, uptown, downtown, all around town. We're making progress on everything, and no one ever says, are you a Democrat or a Republican? They just want to say, can you get up in my pots or what? So,
you know, it's kind of funny. We are here. Has this ever happened to anybody here? We used to be season ticket holders, Orioles. And no, so you go to the games, and we like Cal Ripken, the daughter of Brady Anderson. I think Brady probably took a needle or two, but that's neither here nor there. So we would come to a lot of the games. Have you ever been at somewhere else and they're playing the anthem, and just you're the only person that goes, oh! That happened to me, and people were looking at me, and I'm like, ooh, I'm not done. You just become so accustomed to that thing. I know that's had to happen to somebody other than me.
Or then if we ever go to another stadium, we're like, who that? Who that? We've got to get it together.
You know, that was a great story. When Camden Yards opened, I called Frank Lucchino, who was like the assessor at Allegheny Pine, who was Larry's brother. And I said, Frank, can you call your brother? I want to get season tickets at Orioles. So he called me back like in 3 days and said, all right, you're going to get some tickets, and they're going to be good tickets. And, like, they were great tickets. And I said to myself, boy, I got these, you know, and this is right after President Clinton got elected. And, you know, like anything else in politics, you ask for a favor, somebody's going to call you. Sure enough, 7-8 months later, it's Frank Lucchino on the phone. He said, James, how you doing? He says, how you like those tickets? I said, you're going to love this story. I said, they're great tickets. He said, I have a favor. And I'm like, yeah, you sure? And I'm like, oh, God, this is going to be awful. He said, there's something called the National Library Board. And it, like, doesn't pay anything, but I've always loved libraries. And the president has, like, three vacancies. And I'm like, Frank, I think we can do this. And you can go look it up. He was at the National Board of Libraries. They like meet three times a year. Even though you got to pay your own way to go to Washington. So like a caller said, the tickets, the National. I didn't know, you know what I mean? There's some Saudi prince that he wants to, you know, meet with the, you know, I didn't know what the hell was coming from Frank for those Oreo tickets. But I don't think I've ever told that story before. But Probably the statute of limitation is passed, so I can't go to jail for trading the National Library Board for good oil tickets.
That's great. I have to ask you one thing. Can we talk about pets for a minute?
Okay, if you want to see us get into it.
Can we talk about pets? I mean, I read this part of the book really intensely, and my wife, Dave, Valerie, is reading this part of the book, and she collects every animal that exists on the planet Earth.
Where is that beloved woman?
She was with us. I don't know where she went now, but she, when we first got together, we had, I don't remember, 8, 9, whatever the number of cats were that ended up in our house. And I mean, they're all right, but... But now, and I read this part of your book, and I like animals. James, you don't like them at all.
I don't like animals in a food prep area.
A little cat fur on the butter. You would think he could. It's like not the biggest deal. And let me just say, on behalf of your wife and anybody else in this audience, the presence of multiple cats is not proof of crazy cat ladyism. And particularly in New Orleans, I could not live in a city that wasn't animal caring. In Virginia, we have, I write about the dog park right next to our house. But there, do you remember those pictures? People were not leave the roof without their pets.
Right.
And after the water subsided, all the cats became semi-feral, just roaming the streets. So I adopted, and they don't really live in our house. Sure, they get up in the butter, they get up in the pots, and so they roam around. But they also, like, there's a lot of other critters around. They've cleaned out all the rodents and the other kind of things up and down the block. They come and go as they please. Okay, it was the 7 dogs, the 2 rats, and the 4 birds that kind of threw him over the edge. But they're all like rescue, you know. You can't. Okay, and you know what? This is what I never expected. He never even had a bike. He grew up on a horse. When we were first going out, he so had nothing. I had to buy him a bike when he was 45. He had so nothing in his apartment, which is also his office. It was a Murphy bed by night, his office by day. He was burglarized at one point, and he had so nothing in his house that the thief left a calling card, which was... He pooped.
Right.
He stole his maker's mark and he defecated in his house. He had so nothing. So I thought he'd like a few animals in the house, too. I thought it'd be like a southern kind of thing.
Yeah, where can you get this kind of information on a rainy Friday night? Huh?
I'm just support your animal shelter. Okay, tell you something else. These Walter Reed wounded soldiers, these programs that the shelter dogs that we've matched up with, or the battered women, you know, there's so many great programs with animals that want to be loved and saved and people who want to be loved and saved. And I don't just do it because I want to aggravate him with cat hairs and the butter.
You're listening to my conversation with prominent political couple James Carville and Mary Matlin about their latest book, Love and War, 20 Years, 3 Presidents, 2 Daughters, and 1 Louisiana Home. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll be back with much more of this conversation. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. I'm Mark Steiner, and let's get right back to the conversation I had with James Carville and Mary Matlin last Friday at the Enoch Pratt Free Library about their new book, Love and War.
I love animals. I got nothing against them. I could ride a horse before I could ride a bike. I just don't like animals and food. Maybe that's weird, but it's just a little thing of mine. Yeah, I don't like the cat licking my butter. But well, just agree to disagree on that.
Well, there was one cat. I will leave the cat thing in a minute. But what was the name of the cat that you were trying to get? You were trying to shoo out and get rid of, and it was. Oh. But you were singing him a song.
Here's how ADHD works. There's a really actually a good section about his ADHD, and both of our kids have processing issues. And I never think of this as a disease or a defect, or it's to me. I don't know any genius people that aren't ADHD or don't have some sort of processing.
It's an important part of the book, actually.
So this is a James Carville ADHD moment. Hit the animal antipathy increases as the longer you get there. And I said, okay, promise, nothing else, not one, no more. I'm done, you're right, wearing rats on my shoulders, and I'm cooking pesto, I get it. There's a big rat. Nobody likes rats just because of the tails. But so Matt, our daughter's math teacher, who became the semi-feral cat, Kitty Castle, because drives. She sends around this picture and says, this cat was living with a homeless guy. We found a house for the homeless guy, but we can't find a cat. We need a home for the cat. And she was living in the car, and her tail got chopped off. So who could resist that, right? But my previous adopted cats were kittens, and I hid them, and he never knew. Like, they would just show up, and they thought they just lived in the neighborhood. Well, this was a grown cat with no tail, kind of hard to miss. So it's in his room, and I hear him screaming, Paula, Paula, hey, hey, Paula. And this is right after Jennifer Flowers had moved to New Orleans. You remember Jennifer Flowers, okay? So I never know if James is in real time or past time or future time. He could be in any time. So I thought he was having a Jennifer Flowers, Paula flashback thing, and I go into his room, and he refuses to touch the animals. So he's going, hey, 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 to get Paula off his chair. No human is allowed to touch his chair either. And because he was going, hey, hey, then he goes, hey, hey, Paula. And he starts to go, that's all. He named the cat Paula because that's all he could think of after he said, hey, hey. So I thought Paula could stay, but I was mistaken. And Paula now lives across the street with the Slosses who adopted her. Hey, hey, Paula. ADHD, that's how it works.
Yeah, this is a true story. I was in an airport one time, and somebody came up to me and said, you know, Mr. Carville, I'm the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins or somewhere, I don't know, whatever. And he said, I don't generally make, diagnoses, but I've been looking at you for the last 10 minutes, and I'm pretty sure you got a pretty good case of ADHD. And my wife, it would drive her crazy because I would, she would say something, and then I would drift off and say something else. So we, went to some, high-powered Northwest Cleveland Park psychiatrist who, one of these guys that, just gives you stuff, and, it's a battery of tests and questions and interviews and everything, and so they call us in, and he said, you have a case of
an extreme case.
I've diagnosed it, and that we can offer a certain kind of medication and stuff, and I talked to my wife about it, and I said, I just kind of like the way I am. I don't want to medicate myself to be something else. And I think it really helped our marriage because she understood why, it's like everything in me is to, pick up the iPad to see what the score is or something, or drift off. But, I know don't do it. But that, I do that a lot. And so people that don't know me say, that guy is just jumps up. My mother used to say, boy, it's like a toaster. He just jumps up and down all the time. And I've had any number of people that have said, you know, I first met you, I thought you were rude. And then after I got to know you, I just understand that's just the way you are. You just sort of walk out of a room and be in the middle of a meeting. And
in mid-conversation. Okay, when I come in and I'm spilling out my heart and tears are coming down my face and he picks up the phone and he goes, Stan, you know question number 10 on that poem? I'm like, this went on for like a couple of years. And I said, you don't even listen to him. He goes, yes, you said. And he would repeat verbatim what I'd said that day, the day before, 5 years earlier. He knew. It's like, what good is that? You know, that's not. But now, so now here's how this works. James, focus at me. Look at me. This is how I'm. No, if I really want him to know this means something to me, I swear to God, 90 seconds is all I need. He will. Like this, like laser. He said, okay, we're done here, and it works. And he has a giant big heart, and he does here, even though he is Ken.
But you all accept, here's the thing about that, though, and it's clear in the book, that you all accept each other for who you are.
Yeah, that's how I'm hardly a walk in the park.
Things you come through, right?
It takes us out a while. To get there, you know, our kids, my daughter, my oldest daughter, that she had the same thing. And, remember, God, we took her to, you know, some high-powered, you know, they gave her a test. She was like in the third or fourth grade. And I said, well, this child's really got some issues here. She probably, you know, and so we put her in another school. And, you know, next thing you know, we moved in the arms. We put her in, and she got a. Wins every award. She made straight A's her first year in college. She's but like she's really. So what do they know?
No. Here's what they know.
But every kid, these children, learn
differently.
And I think of all the lives that have just been because we just run them through the same mill.
I'm saying this to mothers, to grandmothers, to educators. Our education, this is not a criticism of the education system, although it is one of our tactics that's working in New Orleans, one kid at a time. And just having a small number of children to one teacher isn't doing it. You've got to get how each kid works. So this kid we're talking about, who's taking junior level courses as a freshman, getting straight A's, couldn't read or write. You know how I taught her how to read? I would read aloud to her Dorothy Parker. So when she was like 7 and 8, she'd run around saying things like, you can lead a horticulture, but you can't make her think. I'm like, okay. Well, and she kept getting positive feedback. One martini, two martini. She goes, watch my mom on 4. Like she would, but it got her understanding that, and she skipped right over the books on the in whatever her processing issue was, she had to read those books. So at 14, she announced she was going to go to France for a month and study expat literature, and she did.
Oh, God, did she not know that?
And she, I mean, we literally didn't think she, we didn't even know if she could get through high school. So
I do know this, that Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Tokas lived on the Rue de Four because she had to take me there and show where they were.
I think one of the toughest single time from the book that y'all went through was Bush v. Gore, you're going to work for the White House, that period where you even described not talking for months and months on end. And you came through that and you ended up going to New Orleans a couple years later. 2008, you went to New Orleans, right? 2008, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, but that was, I mean, that whole story between your two parts back and forth in that period was pretty intense.
Whoa.
Yeah, I did read that half. I did read those parts.
You read those parts?
Yeah, I mean, what happened was I was not happy about it. But with 9/11, then I was very glad because I felt like our family, she was in there, she was, you know, there. And so at that time, I was kind of proud that we had somebody in our family who was really making a contribution. So it kind of changed a lot of it. And we moved. What happened was it was very close. It's kind of one of these things that, we were very close to Tim Russ. He's probably the closest friend I had in Washington. I talked to him every day on the phone, dedicated the book to him. The day that we moved, I got a phone call. I'll talk about it in the book, right at the beginning of the book. And Bow Hunt called, said, "I got worse news than mine. Tim dropped dead." And it was almost like it was just one of these things that, I don't supernatural take what you want, but it was almost like, said, "All right, you want to move? We'll show you. We'll start severing connections here right now." And, but families, I was just more high profile. But people work in different professions or different, couples, some people work here, some people work for different things. And they go through, marriages go through difficult times. Ours is sort of no different than any other marriage. It's just more, ours is over the White House or the Clinton or whatever. But it's not, it's just a higher profile of things that other couples go through and have to face. And, we've been very fortunate, but we tried to go through some of that, talk about some of that kind of stuff in the book.
It's not political per se. The recount, everybody was emotional about that. I don't care if you were living on another planet. It just got to be emotional. And I was done with politics. I'm not a careerist. I've been blessed to work and love the people that I've worked for, but I had a TV job. The kids were 2 and 5. But I really, really had a long-term relationship and affection and appreciation for Dick Cheney. I also could invent my own job. So that was what, but he was already, we were already mad at each other. And then I said, "I'm going to go to the White House." And then then he said, "No, you can't." Well, that's not even a political thing. It's like, I'm 46, okay, I've produced 2 babies, I've had a career, you're going to tell me I can't? Then it wasn't a Republican-Democratic thing, it was like, hey, you have that sign in the bathroom here, I am woman, I'm invincible, I'm tired. Okay, I was kind of said, so then he did not speak to me for 5 months. And said, "Well, good, that checks one thing off my list I don't have to deal with every day." And then, but what the heck? Then what's 5 months out of 20 years?
There you go. We're speaking now.
All right. That part was... The other things that popped out after that part was the respect. You wrote a piece in there, James, about as much as you opposed him, the kind of respect you found for Dick Cheney.
Well, he's right. I did oppose him. He's a personable guy to talk. Most people, when you meet him, President Bush 41, I did everything I could, Like the most frightening person I've ever been around is Bob Bush. Ooh, man. We did a thing at the Bush Library a couple of years ago, maybe not even a couple of years ago, maybe like a year ago. And she would not mention my name for years.
And she did. She had a name for him. It was "He Who Shall Not Be Named."
And she made me sit next to her at the dinner, and man, I was nervous. She said some nice things about it. But when you meet people, it's like different. Because you see them, and that's the thing about political combat. I put in one of my rooms, never go in the green room, because you end up kind of, saying, "Oh, guys just like you." And even President Bush 43, when there was an event, a senior staff event, and obviously I'd go, that was the, and he was wait for me to come. He'd, hey, Carville, come here, come here. Hey, you son of a bitch, have a treat, Mary Bam, kick your ass. You know? But, I mean, he was most, and you know, the same thing with the vice president. We'd go out to Jackson Hole because she'd be the staff person on assignment there. And we'd go, but he'd sort of go out of his way to, and so Mary said, "What? Well, yeah, we're talking about mountains. How did that happen?" I said, "Well, I was sitting there with Dick Cheney. I knew I couldn't talk about politics. I was in Jackson Hole. I looked up and I saw these huge mountains. I said, yeah, Mr. Vice President, how did those, what's the geological structure of those mountains?" And then he just took off. Yeah, sometimes if you're ADHD and you got to make small talk and you're sitting in some mountains, you go, "Well, what the hell about the damn mountains?"
So that very intense picture of those two in the book, they're talking about geological formation. Make that so clear.
Yeah, just kind of what comes to mind if you're in Jackson Hole and you're looking around. And oh, there's the Grand Tetons. How did they get there? But I mean, I found out they're very new. He knew it backwards and forwards. They probably, guy could probably teach a good course of, you know, survey geology somewhere if he had to.
And as a general proposition, I didn't put this in the book, but we've been doing this for 35 years, and it used to be you really didn't divide people by Democrats or Republicans. You divided them by good guys and a-holes. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, it's a technical term in politics. So, like President Clinton, I wouldn't vote for him, but he, whenever he comes to the house, and he comes a lot, even though he's a vegan, there's a place he can come to sneak in some shrimp etouffee. But he loves to come there, and James starts talking politics. He goes, wait, show me this. Who knew he is a connoisseur of obscure
furniture,
antiques? Like, I have this Italian Corona over our bed. James is like, what the hell is that thing for? And President Clinton's late for his own event, a fundraiser at our house, because he wanted to understand all that. And he likes to, he's just an interest. There's nothing that guy doesn't know a lot about and a lot of interesting things about and is not making small talk. Like, he will.
It's the easiest.
And he likes talking to me. I mean, sometimes.
However smart you think he is, you have no idea. You know, and the one of the things I put in the book, the biggest lesson that President Clinton ever taught me is he walks into a room and he finds the most vulnerable person in the room. If you want Bill Clinton to talk to you, have 49 people in the room, not in a wheelchair, and one in a wheelchair, and he's gone right to that guy. And it's instinctive. He just has any topic, anything you can imagine. This has been, Mary's exactly right. If it's antiques, if it's economics, if it's sports, if it's whatever that you want, it's amazing how one human being could just absorb that much. And then also his, the guy wrote a book, and I think that he hit the University of Maryland, maybe somewhere here, and he did a empathy intelligence scale. And no one, his claim was, and he was a man of some expertise, no one has ever scored higher. I mean, you could have, Einstein, who was like off the charts and, empathy, or maybe a guy that was, a Mother Teresa, intelligence, maybe Mother Teresa might have been off the chart in empathy or something, but I mean, the space that you would put in a graph, but he was like way more than anybody else. And he had a way that he devised it. But he is the most, the breadth of his knowledge and ability is to talk about different things. It's, a great conversation.
And you know what else you wouldn't think you would have? Because one thing I can't stand about politicians, hi, how are you doing? And they're doing this and they're looking past you. That's not peculiar to either party. When he's talking to you, he's talking to you. And we were in South America by accident or coincidence together. And President Clinton and I got into a conversation about Zoroastrians, I'm not saying that the right way, early Christians. 45 minutes outside the elevator bank, we're still talking about it. James goes for his run. He comes back. You guys are still talking. Clinton knows he's not going to get my vote. And he's just like, he's a perpetually interesting person. And I'll tell you something else. When Senator Clinton was a senator, one of Dick Cheney's jobs was to be president of the Senate. And she was our go-to girl, so to speak. This is the kind of people who under-promise and over-deliver. She never said she was going to do something and didn't do it. And so there's a lot of reasons to respect people on the other side that are not conveyed in the way in which politics is conveyed to somebody who doesn't work in it today.
We're about to end. Let's end with this. The way you lived your lives, the stories in this book, the stories you really have to tell, what do they say to you all about the larger political picture we're facing in America and the ability to have friendships? Val and I talk about this all the time. We are to the left of center in our world, Valerie and I. Our next-door neighbor is the head of his American Legion post and to the right of most people that I know. We're as close as we can be. We help each other out in our different pieces of property and whatever else happens. There's something missing here that we can't make that bridge and have to define everything by how we view the world politically or religiously. And you two, in some ways, for all the funniness and the stuff you do back and forth and the books you write, you're also telling us something else about how we can live together despite some deep-seated differences in how we view the world.
This is not peculiar to our time. The Pharisees and from the beginning of time, you start with common ground. I mean, start with energy. Why start the things that we know we're going to fight about? I would say that about marriage. If we know we're going to fight about it, why start there? For a myriad of reasons, not least being 24/7 screecher monkey feast-throwing political TV, which is why I hate doing it anymore, and I miss Tim Russert so much. I'm not blaming it just on that, and we're at a unique crossroads where our debt, our structural debt, and some of our problems need to be addressed in ways that are uncompromisable. They're just in the way that the compromise of 1850 did not do anything to prevent the eradication of slavery. But Clinton and the Italian Corona, you and your neighbor, okay, if you start with James and his green room theory, there's not one person in this room that doesn't have something in common with the person he or she would least like in this room if she were forced to.
Amen to that.
Start there.
I'm going to let Mary have the last word on that. I'm going to have the last word. I want to tell a story about libraries because I think it's, important. When I grew up in rural South Louisiana in the 50s, we didn't have libraries. We had something called, I don't know if anybody, maybe they had them in rural Maryland one time, called a bookmobile. And it would come on Tuesday from 2 to 4, then Thursday from 9 to 11 or whatever. And they post a schedule, and they had two ladies, and of course the thing never ran very well. It burned a lot of oil because then they would come in and sort of encourage everybody. So I was a kid growing up in South Louisiana, and the bookmobile came, and some with it now, and they tried to make it pleasant, and they really were committed to try to keep people to read. And so I said, I came in and I asked them if they had some book about LSU football or something. And they said, yeah, We have something like that. I think you should try this book here. And I said, what is this? And they said, well, here it is. It's called To Kill a Mockingbird. I said, well, nobody wants to, like, shoot a mockingbird. And they said, no, you should take it home. You should read it. And I must have been, I don't know, 15 years old or whatever. And we took that book home, and it just changed. And everything, of course, where I grew up, and was all race. And I said, yeah, you know what? The black folks get a bum deal. I just changed my mind right there and just never sought to look back. But, I mean, the point is that you never know who's going to walk into a library, who's going to pull something out, or who's going to, it doesn't have to be identify somebody's political philosophy or something. And, you know, is it making a point that maybe somebody is, you learn something and you provoke a different career. But you don't never know how many lives a library can impact. And that's why it's a big honor to be in this great library here. We were in the New York Public Library yesterday. And when you come out to something like this and support this library, you're really supporting somebody's dream somewhere. And as Frederick Douglass did say, you, as long as you can read, you're always free. And I would only add to the great Frederick Douglass, the more you read, the freer you are. And so I thank Tick Mark. What a great job
thank you
did.
Thank you.
What a great audience.
That was my conversation last Friday with James Carville and Mary Matlin at the Enoch Pratt Library. The new book is titled Love and War, 20 Years, 3 Presidents, 2 Daughters, and 1 Louisiana Home. Please give us a feedback on what you just heard. Tell us what you think. SteinerShow.org. And that's Al Capone by Prince Buster, born on this day in 1899. Great classic. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. If you hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, and find out information about our guests, the work they do, what they've been writing, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.